Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
The second captain's world service.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
Now, times certainly seem to have changed over the last 10 or 15 years.
I have to say, I've really enjoyed this.
Yes, very enjoyable.
Great.
Very enjoyable.
Thanks very much for listening to our first show back, and thank you for all the support. Genuinely, over the last couple of months, we've been absolutely bowled over by it, and we are delighted to be back broadcasting again. Second captains is the phrase I remember. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ken. Mark, Simon,
from Ireland's Second Captain Show.
Second Captain Show.
Hey, lad.
It's the best thing in the world for you, because it's full of protein. Protein.
This is not a dig at football people who know the game.
No respect, no honour.
Put your respect on my name.
Dog shit to bear on.
But who plays rugby?
I imagine it was like something you would expect to see in a porno movie.
No, they don't.
But they
no.
do.
That's very on. They do not.
They have the balls.
Shut up, the two of you. I just want to play commentary at a go.
Far up and out there!
And they still on the
floor. We're a Kukanangas.
I'm a little bit of an idealist. But having said that, I want to be like Nick.
You get the ball forward, you compete, you chase people, you close people down. You create excitement. You win balls when you shouldn't win balls. You commit yourself to the game.
Okay. Take an L deep breath there. This is good and this is meant to happen, okay? Perfect timing.
Whoa, I'd forgotten we had Jack Charlton as part of that audio bed celebrating our 2000th episode. Maybe now is not the time to be reminded of the glory years of Irish football. You're very welcome to episode 2002. Of the Second Captain's Podcast. It is football in this one. 10 games into the Stephen Kenny era. What are we? 3 goals scored, no games won, and now 1 defeat that goes into the history books as a low point for Irish football. Hi, Ken.
Owen, how are you?
I'm ready to rip this plaster off. Hi, Murph.
Hey, Owen. How's it going?
Yes, folks. This is where we're at now after Saturday night, as major tournament football feels like a distant memory.
Congratulations. Take the applause of that crowd.
Like this, that were there a crowd, they would be urging the team on, and you feel that they could feed off that energy, but there just doesn't seem to be the energy of the pitch at this moment. There was the Collins chance in the first half, point blank range. Oh, here's Sean Rodriguez! And it's gone from bad to worse.
Bad to worse is right.
You were far away.
Listen, Tony, I got to come out here and do an interview, but it's a shocking result. It's an embarrassing result,
it's a really, really disappointing result, and you know, it's not good enough.
That is the end of our World Cup hopes, really, isn't it?
What could I say? I was far away.
Crosses back to the edge of the penalty.
We never knew we had it so good, and now we may never have it again. That's the way it's feeling right now. I should say, Murph, it gave Mark no joy putting that bed together, but he's a pro.
Well, I should hope
not. It had to be done.
I mean, if you enjoyed doing that, then there's a level of sadism at work that I didn't know was was present in our work colleague. Oh, it was depressing. Depressing to hear.
John Coughlin emails in, "Dear Second Captains, I'd be interested to know whether I'm the only listener who's contacted you to tell you that you alone, through your tempting and goading of the football gods in your 2000 episode, are responsible for Saturday's debacle. It seems all too coincidental that our biggest footballing humiliation should follow so shortly after your festival of remembrance of the England defeat to Iceland.
Awesome.
I listened to Friday's show on Sunday, and it seemed as though it was Ireland and Travers that Dusty Ken was laughing at." Well, at least poor Travers couldn't be to blame on Saturday, and neither was Bizunu. "As you set off on your next milestone, please refrain from tantalising fate in this cruel manner," says John. P.S. Damn you, Gene. From John there. Well, you know, you aren't the only one, John. We've had a lot of tweets and emails to that effect. Mm. And we can only apologise if indeed we did provoke any footballing gods out there while celebrating our 2000 show. Sorry, Murphy, you're trying to get in.
Oh, no, well, I'm just interested to hear what Comical Early has to make of all this.
What?
I just called you Comical Early.
Put some respect on my name!
Oh yeah, what's that? What's
after that renowned Iraqi propagandist Comical Ali, Ked.
And why would you, what brings Mr. Ali, I don't know what was his actual name, but what brings him to mind? This
Just, there were some people comparing Kenny Cunningham's performance, Roy Curtis, in fact, was comparing Kenny Cunningham's performance on RTE television after the game to the performance of said Iraqi propagandist. And then I opened my Irish Times this morning. Well, I didn't open it. I just went online and read your article, Ken. Yeah, it's a lot of interesting stuff in there.
What you...
The main takeaway being we should have expected that Luxembourg were going to beat us at home. That is normal. In fact, Luxembourg beating us at home is normal.
Well, if we'd done our homework, then we certainly shouldn't have been surprised. But it was a weekend, and who likes to sit down to do the homework on Friday afternoon? Not many people. And so, I don't know what your problem is. I don't know what your problem is, Murphy. You saying you agree with Roy Curtis? It's you.
No, I'm merely poking the bear.
You feel there's been a hysterical Irish reaction. Is that right?
A hysterical Irish overreaction to squeals of outrage, which to my mind are revealing of the arrogance and grandiosity and delusion of many of the people in the Irish football family.
Including their captain.
Including Seamus Coleman.
Yeah, well, it's not just fans saying this is awful, this isn't good, and this is embarrassing. The manager and the captain said the same things afterwards. Stephen Kenny didn't use the word embarrassing, but Seamus Coleman certainly did. So, I mean, the players themselves are putting this down as a pretty awful night, as opposed to the kind of result that we should be expecting. Do you honestly think that was an acceptable performance?
Seamus Coleman says what he has to say. I mean, how many times has this man been wheeled out to justify defeat? He's the captain of Everton as well, you know, Owen.
You'll do it
again.
He's
been around this block a number of times, right? He can recite this speech in his sleep. He's done it hundreds of times at this point in his career. I mean, he became for a while a kind of it's not Comical Ali, because his approach to it has never been to give a, you know, perhaps some might say delusionally positive read on what's just happened. Sure, you may think you just saw Everton lose 7-0 to Udinese or whatever it was, but here's why there was actually five reasons why that game against Udinese. Was it Udinese Everton lost to famously? In the, I remember watching a terrible Europa League game. They were involved in a couple of. My God. But, you know, here's five reasons why that actually may be Everton turning the corner. He's never really done that way. What his way of doing it is, I will strap myself to the rock now, like Cú Chulainn. There's a raven on my shoulder. I'll tear my clothes so that they're hanging down, exposing my chest. And I'll take the arrows, the bullets, whatever else you've got, my chest is going to take them. Because I, Seamus Coleman, understand the pride, understand the suffering that we have put the fans through, and we have to be sorry for that and promise to do better. I mean, that's kind of been his approach. So that's basically what he was doing. You know, oh God, my God, it's so bad, it's so bad. to, like, someone pointed out to me on Twitter there, Mark Ronaldson says, nothing against James Collins, as he seems to be a good pro, but calling the defeat to Luxembourg embarrassing post-match was curious. He plays for Luton. Their striker plays for Dynamo Kiev. I was kind of like, it's true. Like, you know what? Like, where's the sort of the nonsense of thinking that Ireland are so much better than Luxembourg that losing to them represents some kind of a moment of, oh my God, like, we've never been this low. It's just delusional. Like, it shows no understanding of Ireland and no understanding of Luxembourg and little understanding of football. It's just, that's a fact. You know, we were involved in a tight game against a competent team that's been getting better for a long time while we've been pissing about, right? Ireland have wasted the last 20 years like few other countries in the world in terms of international football. We have pissed them away. And here's Luxembourg, a team who have been actually working away and getting better year by year by year by year. And I'd say playing Luxembourg is a bit like playing a sort of like a team in the Belgian first division, like playing against them, like with their academy produced players. You know what I mean? They're like a Belgian academy. That's basically what Luxembourg are like, you know, in terms of they've got like a centralized academy structure. These guys have been playing together for years. They all know each other's games backwards. And we just assume that because we're Ireland and we played an Italian 90 when Luxembourg were knee high to a grasshopper and no one had ever heard of Luxembourg, that we can just sweep them away. But Italian 90 has got nothing to do with it. Italian 90 might as well be the songs of Finn McCool, for all the relevance that they have to what was happening on the pitch on Saturday night. What is the relevant history to that game? The most relevant history is the history of the last few games played by the sides. The next relevant history to that is the history of the FAI over the past 20 years compared to the history of... That's the history that counts. Not like Paul McGrath in Giant Stadium or, you know, Ray Houghton scoring a goal in Stuttgart. That doesn't matter anymore. That's got nothing to do with it. That only gives us a sense of entitlement that we assume we're better than this team that we know nothing about. And when they come along and show us up, you know, it's like what we have now, the reason that there's such an overreaction to it is because it's like the downward mobility. Like downward mobility is the most explosive force in human affairs, right? It's the fear, a terror of downward mobility is what propelled, you know, the shopkeepers of Germany into the arms of the Nazi party, right? That's literally what we're talking about here. And we're like, they're ranked 98th in the world. Where are we even ranked? I must have seen Luxembourg have been ranked. And I said, I must look up where we're ranked because I couldn't give a shit where we're ranked.
I'll check it out.
And I don't know where we're ranked. And what I do know is that I've heard Luxembourg are ranked 98th in the world so many times, but I haven't. I know that I couldn't have read any article where someone had said, well, Ireland, by contrast, are ranked 52nd. Or, you know, where are we?
We're 42nd.
42nd?
Yeah.
Right, okay. So that, you know, 42nd to 98th. I mean, it's a huge gap. Is it, though? Like, is there really a big gap between 42 and 98? Or might it be sort of a bit of a muchness? Are you looking at the list there? Can you see any teams like in the 40 to 60 bracket that you reckon Ireland might struggle to beat?
Hungary are 40th. Australia are 41st. The Czech Republic are 42nd, along with ourselves.
I thought you said we were 42nd.
Joint 42nd. Norway are 44th.
Joint 42nd?
Joint 42nd, yeah.
Whoa, these are finely calibrated rankings.
They really are.
We're exactly as good as the Czech Republic.
Yeah, we are no better and no worse. Ken, on Friday,
I offered you a scrappy 1-0 win against this Luxembourg team, who you're now talking about as this great behemoth of European football, and you refused to take it.
No, not a behemoth. Please, don't caricature my argument. Please. Can't we discourse upon this as rational men? I simply said that Luxembourg are a competent team. I didn't say that they're the best team Ireland have ever played, or, you know, we must all cower before the might of our Luxembourg overlords. What I am saying is that they are a decent side. They're not a joke team, right? They're a competent team. And when you're playing a game like that, you're not playing particularly well, and you make a chance and you miss a chance, and then you make another chance and you miss another chance, and then they smash one in from like a half chance, and win 1-0, you've got to go, well, fair enough.
But
no, that's
missed
the
chance.
Way football is.
Football, as Seamus Coleman says, it's all about dealing with adversity, and missing a chance is something that's going to happen in a game of football. And I don't remember the other chances you talked about that we created. Do you honestly think, allowing for the fact that Luxembourg were better, it's the best damn Luxembourg team we've ever seen and all that. I mean,
it's the best damn Luxembourg team we've come up against.
Allowing for
not the first time they've taken the lead against Ireland at Lansdowne Road.
Do you? Well, we needed a Paul McGrath volley back in those days to dig us out of a hole there. But we're not here to talk about Paul McGrath, as we already said.
No.
And those glory days. We're here to talk about the Irish performance in the face of the team that they were up against.
Mm.
Do you honestly feel it's just a case of we missed a chance, we're a bit downhearted, we end up getting sucker punch? I don't even think it was a sucker punch. I mean, I think they deserve to win as much as we deserve to win. So you don't seem to feel there's any issues with the Irish performance and with the way the team, by extension, with the way the team is being managed at the moment.
No, the Irish performance was not good. Like, no one's saying that this was good. This was bad. This was a bad performance. But does it sort of mean that Seamus Coleman should be coming out and sort of tearing his garments and throwing himself down in a basement before the nation? Like, please heap all the guilt onto my shoulders. Someone has to carry the can. I, Seamus Coleman, will do. You know, Coleman marching through the streets while someone walks behind him ringing a bell. You know, like, is that warranted? No,
let's
it's just a game.
Let's play a little bit of Coleman here, actually, because there's a lot of stuff about not having the team, not having pride in the shirt and stuff, which is always the emotive stuff. But there was a more specific tactical point that he made. He was asked by Tony O'Donoghue, why was it so flat?
As players, we need to have a good hard look at ourselves. Like, you need people demanding the ball out there, and I don't think we've done that enough. If we're building up one side, then you need people to want it out the other side. And I don't think we heard enough voices. So, listen, Tony, I got to come out here and do an interview, but there's no words for that there. That's embarrassing on behalf of everyone at home watching. As players, we take that in the chin, but it's nowhere near what we wanted.
Now, that answer, I think that's actually, in some ways, more damning of what's going on with this Stephen Kenny team than this sort of impossible to measure, idea of how much pride there is in the shirt. This is a team that's supposed to be defined by bravery and possession. This is the one thing that Stephen Kenny assured us we would have under his watch. And we're now 10 games in, and against a team ranked near the ranked 90, whatever in the world, we, according to our captain, didn't want the ball. The players weren't looking for the ball. I mean, that's extraordinary. I think that's a real damning indictment of where we're at.
Yeah, I think it's over the top, to be honest, from Coleman. I mean, you know, again, I think the criticism, like Mr. Ronaldson says, how can James Collins be embarrassed about being outclassed by Dynamo Kiev striker? Like, do you think if Gerson Rodriguez was Irish, James Collins would have been in our team last night? I mean, probably not.
No, but again, I'm going back to the Irish performance. The idea that we should be showing for the ball, that all our players, it's a chance to get to a World Cup. It's a chance to at least keep alive. We're supposed to have our confidence built up somewhat from our performance the other day. As Stephen Kenny said, it's the first week he's had where there hasn't been COVID situations or any interruptions. So the excuses are gone at this point. You have to at least want the ball to show what you can do against Luxembourg or any other team at home. And we didn't apparently want to do that.
I mean, again, wanting the ball, like Coleman has he's talking about psychological factors here, right? You use the word tactical, but that's not a tactical point. That's a point about the character of the players, their lack of courage, their lack of bottle. You know what I mean? It's not really a tactical point. I mean, there was a tactical problem in the game. I mean, we can talk about this. You know, when the first half was pretty frustrating, and I was sitting there wondering, when is something going to be done about this Kieran Clark, Enda Stevens corner of disaster that we've somehow managed to create here on our left side? You know, because Luxembourg in this game were saying, okay, it was as though someone had watched videos of Kieran Clark and Enda Stevens. Yeah. I thought, particularly Clark, because he was the free man. He was the guy they said, okay, why don't you have the ball and you can start the moves? We're happy enough with that. And Clark, and what about if we give you the only pass that we're going to give you, the obvious one is to Enda Stevens, because everyone else is sort of going to be marked up. And you could try and go across the defense if you want, but you're sort of reluctant to do that for obvious reasons. You don't really want to, you know, what with our strikers in close attendance to O'Shea and Coleman and sort of blocking off the Coleman-Doherty thing. You know, Coleman and Doherty being, I guess, one of the combinations that Stephen Kenny has devised a system to put into the team. But there isn't really a similar kind. Let's have a look at this Clark Stevens thing. And Clark has the ball, and Clark is giving it to Stevens, and then Stevens doesn't have anywhere to go, so he gives it back to Clark. And the Luxembourg players are now pressing in on them, and it's all getting a little bit ooh. And this and if you look at the game, Clark had more touches than practically than he had the most touches in the game. I think it was 111 touches. Stevens, I think, was next most. And both of them had more touches than any Luxembourg player. Like Miles, you could have taken like any four Luxembourg midfielders, I think, and Clark has more touches in the game. Okay, this is the wrong person to have being that dominant in the game. What I wondered was, why are we sticking with this when, like you could tell after half an hour, okay, the shape of the team isn't really working like it was the other night. The one chance that we did create was when we actually managed to, the one time we escaped from that situation, without sort of giving it away or you know, like kicking it out of play for a throw or something.
Yeah, and we did that because Enda Stevens controlled it quite well and managed to get it back to our keeper.
Back to Bazunu.
Good stuff. And then suddenly, then there is the space on the other side and they got it out to Doherty.
Yeah, Bazunu played, I mean, I have to say, when I saw that pass to Doherty, I thought, well, why wasn't this guy playing on Wednesday?
Yeah, that's another...
Everyone was, I think everyone was looking at that going, well, Jesus, you know, I mean, I guess there's the pecking order consideration, you know, there's all that, but then you've also got to decide based on ability, like just the ability on the ball Bazunu showed in that moment in terms of picking out the pass to Doherty, almost leave aside all the goalkeeper stuff that we could have done with that. We could have done with that rather than Travers against Serbia. But again, look, this is water under the bridge. It's something to keep in mind going forward. He picks out Doherty, and then it goes through midfield and out to Robinson the other side. And it's a lovely move, and it should be a goal. It's not a goal. And, you know, if it had been, I think the whole conversation out of the game is different. But okay, we go back to what was going wrong. You're like, okay, surely we're going to change something about this. Maybe a change to... four at the back, even though, you know, we were all happy with this. Well, not all. I said lots of people were criticising the three at the back, including, I think, Damien Delaney, who we're going to talk to. Mm.
Well, the second Matt Doherty got injured, the whole...
That's the thing.
The raison d'etre for having a 3-5-2 was to get Coleman and Doherty in the team. The second Doherty is no longer available to be in the team, then that negates
so
the need
that's,
for... And, like, you so know, that's, and that's a big that's part of the job, weird. Ken. Like, that's a massive part of the job, is making changes... you know, on the hoof in games, particularly when things aren't really going our way. And that's, you know, and like that's on Stephen Kenny without any shadow of a doubt. I mean, I understand the point that you're making, that the reaction can be hysterical, and Stephen Kenny can also be doing not a very good job. As Simon tweeted on Sunday, I mean, you can have a terminal illness and your house can still go on fire, you know?
Yeah.
And like, they're big errors. Like, that's a big error that Stephen Kenny made. No,
well, I mean, again, like that, this is we're in the realm here of you know, Monday morning quarterbacking or whatever. You know, it's all sort of hindsight. I mean, but I think it's normal to look at games and go, well, this should have happened, that you know, that should have happened. What if we'd done this? That didn't work. I mean, what didn't work is okay, Doherty being injured then is like, okay, now it's like logical to switch to four because we've got four defenders still on the pitch who can play as a four, with Coleman at right back, with Stevens at left back, and O'Shea and Clark in the middle. Doherty is now gone, so what are we going to do? We're going to change the system around. But what he did was, instead, he took Alan Brown and moved him to right wing back. Now, he justified this later by saying Brown has plays a bit of right wing back for Preston, apparently. Okay, maybe he has played the position, maybe he even likes the position, I don't know. But for Ireland, Brown was the main sort of support attacker. Like, he was the most likely player to get on the end of something in the box because he is the player who runs into the box. Mm-hmm. I mean, Collins obviously is there because he's the center forward, or, you know, but Brown is the guy who will actually attack the box with runs. Brady, who's a player who came on and assumed the position that Brown had been in, doesn't want to go into the box. He wants to pass the ball into the box. But there's no use having someone who can put in those good deliveries. And Brady did put in a couple of good balls. Mm. There was a brilliant cross from the right across the six-yard box, which Shane Long just completely, like, I was looking at, how can he just, it's just unbelievable. You know, it's, he's got, like, Long.
was it as bad as a moment later on when Long had about 2 minutes to work out how he was going to control a high ball that was coming down to him?
This was the Brady one from the left. That was the other good ball.
Yeah, yeah, no, but that's my point. The one on top is the one that he decides to handle.
Oh, he handled it.
Yeah.
That went 50 yards 50 yards across and 90 yards up in the air.
Oh, no.
And could yeah, I mean, that was
you know, that, so that wasn't good. Like, you know, someone actually tweeted us when Mr. Ronaldson, who my good friend from Twitter this morning, making the
we
point
we should get this lad to host the show.
Well, he sees these things. I just read out his thoughts.
Ronaldson thinks cogently by the sounds of things.
He does.
Well, Ronaldson makes this point, but then someone else comes in saying, Davey Dublin says, extremely childish comment, Ken. Well, I think he means Mr. Ronaldson. Our manager could have picked Shane Long, similar style, but far superior. This is to Collins, I assume, with huge international and premiership experience. Overall, our squad would be considered far superior to theirs. Only an idiot would suggest otherwise. Time to grow up. Shane Long has got no goals and one assist in his last 16 appearances, going back to Moldova in 2016. You know, Collins has got 2-8 now in international games, which isn't, like, amazing, but, like, it's better than 0-6. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not saying Collins is brilliant, but, like, I think it's a struggle at this point to insist Shane Long is far superior. Anyway, what I'm saying is Brady did put in a couple of good balls. We didn't have players who could put those in. I forget who actually crossed it for the one that Collins just put wide of the post, you know, the little sort of over his shoulder effort. Brown, so I thought moving Brown out to the wing was a mistake. And then, and the second half was a worse performance from Ireland than the first half, which already wasn't good. You know, McLean came on and you know, he had, I think, like, no successful balls, I mean, which is fairly typical, but, like, he crosses from the wrong positions. But even, you know, he's actually playing as a wing back anyway, so it's hard to get into a good position to cross. Like, so the whole thing sort of turns into a mess. Then Luxembourg scored out nothing. Then the other interesting moment, I thought, was the double substitution with 5 minutes to go. Because that was an interesting political move, I thought. Why is it? Because look at who's sitting on the bench. Look at who's left on the bench. I mean, it's Hendrik, really, who's the player who would be sitting there. I don't know what Hendrik was thinking. I mean, part of him, I'm sure, was insulted. Part of him was thinking, well, at least this isn't on me. You know what I mean? Like, if there's a game that you're left on the bench for, you know, then I'm happy to have no part in this disaster. But to bring on Malumbi and Parrott, okay, it's kind of a snub to Hendrik. It's like saying, not you. I don't really have any faith that you can contribute anything here. I'm going to bring on these much younger players than you. Like, remember, Hendrik is nearly 30 now. Like, he's one of the senior players in this squad. And this is a 5-substitution game. And he doesn't even make the top 5 substitutes. And the guys who come on are Malumbi and Parrott, two kids. So that's quite insulting to Hendrik. Now, the fact that it's insulting to Hendrik isn't important in and of itself. It's like, if Stephen Kenny looks at Hendrik and thinks, I'm, to be honest, not blown away by your contributions. I don't really see what the point would be of putting you on here. Okay, that's fine. You accept the fact that maybe you make an enemy in Hendrik there, or, you know, an enemy is maybe dramatic, but, like, you know, if you're in Hendrik's position and this happens to you, you're like, all right, well, you know, if we do have another manager in the autumn, like, sounds all right by me. You know what I mean? Like, this guy doesn't even consider me one of his best 5 substitutes. But I think if you're going to do that, then really, ideally, you'd have given the guys you've put on a bit longer than 5 minutes to show that it was a good decision. Like, it just seemed like a move that didn't have much upside, considering the downside, the cost of doing it. Like, again, you know, is this all a little bit mean girls, the stuff I'm going on with here? Does Hendrik really think, yeah, look, this is how footballers think. It is insulting. You know what I mean? Mm. It's like, oh, all right, okay, well, fine, fair enough. That would be a normal way, I think, for Hendrik to think. And I just thought, if you're going to do that, do it a bit earlier. Because these guys, you know, then maybe they've got a chance to do something. As it was, it's just kind of like,
well, the goal was,
oh,
the
no,
earthquake.
We're going to lose.
The goal
was the earthquake. But, like, at that point, it's like, okay, stick them on. By the way, fuck you, Jeff. Right, get out there, lads. Oh, it's final whistle. Mm. You know, it just sort of seemed like, oh. But, you know, again, this game isn't about Jeff Hennig. What I'm saying here, Owen, is that yes, there were mistakes. It's not the first time I've seen mistakes at a game made by players, made by the manager. I've seen it many times. But the notion that it's like this is just different from what's come for. This is like a new low. This is a moment to make us go, well, hang on, this just isn't working out. I just kind of feel...
Well, because we'll get into this, but the other managers that have made mistakes in a lot of cases have also won big games as Ireland manager. Stephen Kenny has yet to win a game of any description as Ireland manager. So it's not like he's proven that his methods have worked and now we've hit a bump in the road.
Well, he has proven.
No, for Ireland at international level, he hasn't proven that it works at all.
Well, no, but I mean, there are like a ton of reasons for that. I mean, do we really have to go back over all this? You know what I mean? Like, Stephen Kenny hasn't even got to play for an Irish crowd yet. You know, there hasn't even been a crowd at one of the games.
Yeah, there haven't been a crowd at any games in any international stadium. Majority for a long time.
But the point,
other teams are winning matches.
One of the main points from the piece that I have to write about this game is that if you look at the Luxembourg team, those players play together the whole time. So if you look at the Nations League, 9 Luxembourg players started at least 5 Nations League matches. 7 of those players were involved in the game last night. What I'm saying is, this is a team that has played together a lot, and they know each other. They know what it is to play together as Luxembourg. They know what they're trying to do. They've had a lot of practice doing it. Right, much more so than Ireland. If you look at Ireland, we only had 3 players who played as many as 5, or started as many as 5 games in the Nations League. They were Doherty, Duffy, and Randolph. Randolph was injured. Duffy wasn't playing. Doherty's the only, and he only played 45 minutes. And then the next most common player in the Nations League who played the most was Brady, who started 4 of the matches. Now, what I'm saying is that you've got lots and lots of players who have been in and out. We used 30 players in that competition over 6 matches, right? That's like nearly 3 teams worth in 6 matches, 3 completely different teams in 6 matches, right? Do you see the point here? There's no consistency of selection there. And that hasn't been because Stephen Kenny's been chopping and changing. Oh, I'm not sure about this. I decided that the last time, but I want to change my mind and pick a completely different. It's because it's been forced by circumstance. The circumstances have been bizarre. Everything about it has been bizarre. And yet you want to make the decision. You want to say, well, the lesson I draw from this with the, you know, as a series of cobbled together Ireland teams who've never played together before fail somehow to immediately ignite and play brilliant football. Although there was some decent moves at the very least, because they failed to they have failed to produce amazing football. I conclude from this that this guy Stephen Kenny hasn't got what it takes.
Not amazing football, no, not amazing football, but coherent football would be nice. A sense that this is a team coming together. A game plan that can potentially not lose at home to Luxembourg would be nice, I have to say. You know, and I'm sure I'm not the only one. Everyone presumably at this point, and not everybody, that's not fair to say, but a lot of people who really want Stephen Kenny to succeed, I think, are starting to have doubts about whether that's going to happen, notwithstanding all the mitigating circumstances.
Well, I'll tell you this. If it continues that Stephen Kenny is never able to pick a consistent team of any kind, that it's just always this continual circulation of players through the team. So players are injured, or, you know, Connolly can't make it, or they're not fit enough, or blah, blah, blah. If that continues to be the case, there's no way he's going to succeed. But I'll tell you this, right? Yeah. You get rid of him and hire Big Sam or whoever it is you and Curtis want, and he's not going to succeed. He's not going to succeed either in the same circumstances, right? So what I'm saying is, hold your horses with the, oh, this just isn't working out, and acknowledge the fact that in these circumstances, you would have had to be pretty lucky for things to work out as they've gone. And as we know, Stephen Kenny has not been.
Richie was, I thought, showing the first signs of losing a little bit of faith on the RT panel on Saturday night. Meanwhile, across town in the Virgin Media Studios, Damien Delaney was laying into the performance. We have got these two giants of Irish football punditry on together on today's show to thrash out where we're at with this team and management. They're on the way after I tell you a little bit more about our 2000 podcast series that we're running over the next month to celebrate this little landmark that we hit on Friday. Kicking off tomorrow with Greg Louganis, who made Olympic history in the 1980s when he won double gold medals in LA and again in Seoul 4 years later, where he won gold despite smashing his head off the diving board in one of his events in one of the most incredible performances in Olympic history. He later revealed that he'd been diagnosed with HIV in the run-up to those Olympics in Seoul in 88. This is a guy with just an unbelievable story, and we're really looking forward to having him on the show tomorrow. We're also going to have guest presenters over the next few weeks, like David O'Doherty.
Happy Christmas!
And Caitlin Thompson, special guests from outside the world of sport, and some blasts from the past, like this guy.
It was a great day, and I had me cup of tea and me hang sandwich. It was fantastic.
Yeah, Roddy's going to give the full story behind his being snubbed by Ken Early while Ken was going for a run in the Phoenix Park a while back. So much great stuff for our members over the next while. You can join up now on secondcaptains.com for a fiver a month plus VAT. Let's do this.
John Delaney could run anything. I think the FAI are fortunate that they were able to track somebody of his caliber.
I'm delighted to announce on behalf of the FAI that Mick McCarthy is our new international manager.
It's 2 years time. You know, we don't know what will happen.
The senior team is not my brief. My brief is the under-21 international team.
Further announcement today is that Stephen Kenny will commence as our under-21 manager.
What if he comes in and rips it up with the 21s?
In August 2020, yeah, I'm taking over, and that's been decided.
You want to give the amount of money? But I can say it's at least €100,000 in cash.
No, it's not in writing, it's just...
No, it's in writing, yeah.
We have to write the checks tomorrow morning. The credit line and the ability to pay is there. Full stop.
We're in good shape, Dad. You just keep getting better. I got this.
We're announcing two grassroots initiatives today, Ken, for the Vantage seats. For as little as €100 a month on direct debit over 10 years, you can be assured of your Vantage seat.
You are... fucking idiot.
We have to do what we're doing. We have to do it. And we're doing it.
And after the Euros in 2020, Stephen will take charge of the senior international team.
Disgraceful reaction to that. But listen, I woke up to listen to it again because that's the last game. I'll see you when I see you. I'm out of here.
Mate, see you. Mate. A bit more about that. John Delaney.
Well, just before we get to the two guys, Ken, you have just attended Stephen Kenny's virtual Zoom press conference. How was the boss man today?
Well, I'd say he had his tail up, Owen.
Really?
He'd had a little bit of time to lick his wounds and to compose a little stump speech in which he kind of laid out the case. For, you know, there's been a lot of doom and gloom as we've been talking about. A lot of people have been screaming hysterically about, you know, you can't lose to Luxembourg. And, you know, notwithstanding that, you know, Stephen Kenny kind of, it's not like he's saying actually the Luxembourg game was not a bad result. He's accepting it was a bad result. But he talked about how he's kind of happy with how things are going. Like, the, you know, for instance, he mentioned the Serbia game was the best. He described it as probably the best away performance by an Irish team in several years. So that was his opinion of it. He talked about how, you know, our aim was to introduce young players. You know, we feel like we've kind of done that, bonding with the existing senior players. Then he started talking about they've got a 9-day training camp planned in Spain where a lot of things are going to come together. That's in June. Friendlies against Andorra and Hungary. But we can work on the collective way we want to play. It's obviously a big letdown losing to Luxembourg. That has been the big disappointment here. However, big picture, things are going okay.
Okay, well, we'll see. Damien Delaney and Richie have been listening to that. Richie, how I hear Damien laughing and Richie kind of tutting disapprovingly. Richie, how are you, first of all?
Go to the laugh first.
Okay, Damien, the laugh first. You're not so sure things are okay, are you?
No, listen, things will be okay. And he has to put on a brave face. I get that, you know, and I wouldn't expect anything else from him. And I'm glad that he said his tail was up, because it's important, you know, that he kind of gets himself going again. It's not the be-all and end-all. You know, it's happened now. We got to accept it. We got to live with it. And we got to move forward. You know, we always knew that this transition was going to be difficult. And until we kind of made the transition, we were never going to fully understand where exactly we were. And I was hoping, and I think everyone did, that we'd be further up the road than what we were, or what we are, sorry. So, the cold reality of international football and making a change is very, very difficult. And he's trying to unpick, I suppose, 10, 12 years of neglect. And it's very, very difficult to do that overnight. I was hoping that we'd be able to do it while maintaining some sort of positive results and keep the keeping people's spirits up. And I think we were able to say that, to manage and sell that, I suppose, that we were playing reasonably well football. There was signs, there was a notable shift. You know, I came out with all these kind of buzzwords or sentences, and I was really, really pleased. But then, my God, we came crashing back down to earth against Luxembourg, where, you know, we weren't at the races at all. And I said after the game, and I still maintain that we are on the right path. We just need to get better at what we're doing. Because the way that we were approaching international football, the way that we were approaching games, was, you know, it was going to become extinct really, really soon. The likes of Georgia, all the top four nations that traditionally we'd, you know, put up a good score against and have a nice night, were creeping up on us. And not only were we stagnating, I felt we were regressing. So it was only a matter of time before those guys passed us. But hopefully now we've put the handbrake on. We probably dropped a little bit further than what I was hoping, but hopefully we can start moving forward now. I'm still positive. I'm still pleased with Stephen. I'm still hopeful for him, because I think he deserves a good long crack at this.
What are we basing that on, though, Damien? I mean, at what point do we accept Stephen Kenny is just not doing a very good job as Republic of Ireland manager?
Okay, first of all, I would say to you there, Owen, that the method has to remain. Whether Stephen is the man or not to implement it, it remains to be seen. But we can't change the path that we're on now, because we are on a path. The likes of Georgia's and Albania's and all these teams, they started this path 10, 12 years ago. And they were as bad as what we were against Luxembourg, and we were beating them. But they were improving. They had kind of removed the ceiling off the bungalow, and the sky was the limit, or will be the limit for them. If they can keep producing better players, the future of Georgian football, and I keep referring to Georgia because, you know, they are a team, I think, that, you know, they competed with Spain the other night. But I remember when we played them in 2008, in one of my caps, we won 4-0. It was one of the handiest nights of football that I was ever involved in. I remember we played Northern Ireland back in 2008. Again, one of the handiest nights of football. No, I think we would really, really struggle, because those teams have progressed. So the method remains the same. Now, when I say Stephen doesn't necessarily have to be the guy, I'm not advocating for him to be sacked. Absolutely not. I mean, no way. I think he has to be given a good crack at this, a good 2 years, at least this qualifying campaign, if not a little bit longer, because, as I said, he's been asked to unpick something. And the only other alternative is to just throw the towel in and say, well, let's, you know, rehire a 4-4-2 merchant, and let's just see how long we can hang on for this and maybe garner a little bit of success. That is not the way forward. That is a dead end. And if we keep going down it, eventually we're going to hit rock bottom. And for me personally, I think we'd be better off just not competing international football rather than staying on the road that we're on, because it is, as I said, a dead end.
It felt a little bit like rock bottom last night, though, I have to say, Richie, or on Saturday night, I should say.
I was going to say that. I'm hoping we are at rock bottom. I'm hoping that we'll reflect back on these couple of games and Saturday in particular as the low point that we all remember, but from which everything there, the graph just... There was an upturn in the graph since. And it doesn't have to be like a vertical line. It doesn't have to be immediate. It doesn't have to be hugely impressive. But we need, I think, a sign now that things are going to go in the right direction. Because, and this is, obviously, this is way too simplistic. Like, but, you know, people have talked about this, and I hate applying this term to discussions about football. There's like this culture war or culture debate or whatever about the people who were convinced that Stephen was the right man and his ideas were what was needed, and the others that were sceptical and dismissive and were waiting for him to prove that he was the right person or that his methods were worth supporting. Like a home defeat in a competitive game to Luxembourg in your 10th game, 9 games into a winless streak. Like that's, I don't think that can be brushed over. Like the flip side, if you wanted to say, like the opposite is, you know, to go 9 games unbeaten and then beat Portugal at home in a competitive game. That's as much of a hammer blow for one of these two sides in this little kind of culture debate as is possible. Like I was there on Saturday and I was really looking forward to the game, partly because I'd get to attend a match, an Ireland match, a competitive match. Like RT don't show the Nations League games, so this is my first time to be at a match where Stephen was managing, and you know, I thought, you know, I'm going to be there. It should be a win. We're hoping it will be a win. And then the longer the game went on, I remember speaking to Kenny about 20 minutes before the end, where you're always, you know this from working in Premier Sports, you know, you check in with each other now and again. okay, have we got the right pieces of analysis lined up? Where we go full time if nothing changes between now and the final whistle? And we were kind of gathering our thoughts as to, Jesus, what's the significance here of a nil-all draw? Like, that's not great. Like, that's quite damaging. And then, of course, a few minutes later, they scored. And the nearer you got to the final whistle and just looking around, honestly, the mood in the place, it was so hard to describe, because on the one hand, it was just so bleak. Like, it was just a big, empty arena, virtually nobody there. But in the inside, we're thinking, this is an occasion of real significance here. This is going to be spoken about.
Why is it so significant, Richie? Because compare it to
what group of results does that defeat belong? We're
pot three, they're pot four. I mean, it's not unheard of that you lose the team in the pot below. I'm sure it's not the first time it's happened to us.
Can I jump in there? You're dead right. There was a time where it was unthinkable. But we've been sinking, and that was my point at the start of this, very, very slowly. And they've been progressing very, very slowly. And the gap now isn't huge. I kept using the example of Georgia, but they're probably equally an example. They're probably a bit further behind than Georgia, but they're catching up with us. And I can guarantee you in 5 years' time, they'll be in pot three and we'll be in pot four with the way we were going. So it has to stop and it has to turn around.
Yeah, I totally agree that we need to try something different from what we're doing. But I wonder, when you're talking about that, Richie, like, what was it about that game that made you think, oh, hang on, this is really bad? Like, beyond just like, oh, here's another game where it hasn't really happened for us. We've missed our chances. They've scored theirs. That's football. You kind of thought, no, this is a sort of a turning point. What was it about it? I mean, did you think that the management of the game by Stephen Kenny was particularly bad? Like, were there mistakes that were screaming out to you at the time? What is he doing? You know, or I can't believe he hasn't changed this. Or, you know, was there anything of that nature to make you think, okay, until today, I thought we were basically going in the right direction, but now I'm not so sure.
I think I was always open to the idea that we're going in the right direction, and I still hope we are. And I think we are, in terms of the way in which Stephen talks about Irish football and the potential of Irish football and how we should view ourselves as a footballing nation. I think whoever his predecessor or his successor is, whenever it arrives, I think it's imperative that they're of the same view. And that we don't regress and we don't bring in someone who is exactly like what Damien described, somebody who will do something that we were accepting 10 years ago. I really hope we're on a path that we don't deviate from. But we do have to have a conversation about whether or not the person in the driving seat is the right one. Now, and the specifics of Saturday, well, first of all, the nature of a qualification campaign, but certainly of professional football or elite level football is... There's a conversation about ideas and strategies and selections and availability of players and, you know, ability to deal with injuries and disruptions to training camps. But your fundamental job is to win games. And I think I see what you're saying, Ken, that we've only lost to somebody who is just one rung below us in the seeding. And that in itself isn't great. But it's a home defeat against... In a team where, to be honest, I was watching, I don't know what you thought, but... Did you think it's inevitable for the goal? We're just any minute now the goal will come
for Ireland.
Yeah,
No.
That's what I mean. Like I can. I asked a moment ago. In what company does this result belong?
Well, what about? And you can think back. We lost to Iceland a couple of years ago.
Can I say? I think it is probably the worst, because from what I remember of all the other games, the Macedonians, the Cypruses, and stuff. We had large chunks of the game.
And yes, sometimes, and we battered the goal. Yeah.
You have off nights and the keeper's man of the match and you're going away going, Jesus, like, how did we not win that? You know, and it was so freak. They got a 30-yard goal. They got a dodgy penalty. You kind of go, fair enough. But Luxembourg battered us in terms of, like, maybe not battered us, a bit harsh, but they competed with us and they were better than us at what we were trying to do. Mm. So that's why I think it was so stark and so bad, to be honest. Yeah, is that they deserved it and they fully deserved it.
You tell me, when you were talking about this game, that I was interested that after the Serbia game, which Stephen Kenny, as I mentioned, described as the best performance he's seen from an Irish team away from home in years. But after that game, which did have some promising aspects, I guess, and it was a couple of unfortunate moments with the goals that we conceded. You said after that you didn't like the system. That, you know, I think Brian Carr agreed with you on our version that neither of you had liked the three at the back, which we continued to use all the way through against Luxembourg. I'm guessing if you didn't like it against Serbia, you really didn't like it by the end of the Luxembourg. I just wonder what your issue is with it. You think it's just...
Oh, I can go into that. You know, obviously on Virgin, you have a limited amount of time and it's very difficult to kind of really get your point across. But 3-5-2, an orthodox, and Richie will know what I'm talking about, an orthodox 3-5-2 went out of fashion about 15 years ago. Nobody does it anymore. There's only a handful of teams still play 3-5-2. And 3-5-2, the teams that do play it, think of the likes of Sheffield United. They're not conventional 3-5-2s. You know, Sheffield United with a lot of rotation, centre-backs joining in. It's a clever one. But when the year Sheffield United first came up, they caught everyone by surprise. And then the summer came and everyone thought, what are they actually doing? That cannot be as good as what they're making it out to be. And then over the summer, all the analysts and every Premier League club would watch Sheffield United, found the weak spots, and they went, okay, next year we're going to get them. And as soon as people found the weak spots and what Sheffield United were doing, they're done for, right? And 3-5-2, there's an awful lot of weak spots. A lot of Italian teams still use it, but they use it for the benefit of going to five at the back because they don't mind sitting in and sorting the pressure. Like the Napoli lose it, Atalanta to an extent use it, but again, they're very unorthodox like Sheffield United. But watch them. Every time they lose the ball, they're a flat back five and it almost becomes 5-4-1. The only manager I know of recently, and I'm open to correction on this, is Antonio Conte at Chelsea in 2016 that had any success with a 3-4-3 is what he played. But any time Chelsea lost the ball, it became 5-4-1 instantly, right? And that's just to give you a little bit of solidity. And then when you win the ball back, you either counterattack like Conte did with the likes of Eden Hazard and Diego Costa, or you retain possession long enough to regain your 3-5-2 shape because it has its benefits. You get to play with two up front, you get to keep your three in midfield and obviously your wing backs. But for me, 3-5-2 is an interesting one. It can work if you show up on a Saturday afternoon and it's a curveball and the team that you're playing against aren't expecting it because then they find it very, very difficult to adjust to it. And sometimes by the time they adjust, you might have your nose in front or the kind of die's been cast in the game. And
you think maybe that happened a bit against Serbia then?
Maybe, but I still saw enough weak spots against Serbia. You think of the Mitrovic goal. The reason I don't like it is Kieran Clarke's a centre-back and he went in with, Tadic? No, the ball got flicked to Tadic, but he went in, right, and he's left side of three. As soon as he went in, there's now nobody on the left side of your pitch. If you're playing in the back four, you have a left back outside you. So when you go in, you've got Gaucher on your right and Ender Stevens on your left, and that ball gets popped in. I mean, it was a good run by Mitrovic. It was so obvious that was a run he was going to make because as soon as Clarkey went in, there was nobody there. It didn't even have to be a good ball, you know, and that got played in. As well with the first goal, when the ball got played in really flat and Clarkey went to win it, and it was too flat for him to go and win it. So that's the kind of case where you got to get contact on the centre forward, nudge him so he can't direct the header where he wants to direct it. So if you can't get there, you got to get him. And you risk giving away a foul, but such is life. At the minute, you're in a bad, because ultimately the best decision there is for Clarkey to stay or to, you know, maintain his shape. And if you're in a flat back four, you know, you might do, but Kieran's quite a front foot defender. So there's a couple of mistakes in that. But also as well, I think that Darrell Shea would have been a bit closer to him. The right back might have been in touch. So there's weak spots in it. So what I'm saying is, when you show up on a Saturday and then you throw a curveball at a team, you might get them sometimes. But when you show up the following week and the opposition know what you're doing, then I think you're done for, because it's so easy to stop 3-5-2 when you know what's coming. Because you have wing-backs who are out on the edge of the pitch on their own, Matt Doherty and Ender Stevens. And all you do is just let the ball go there. They're then isolated. And then you keep them wide, but then show them back inside to where you've got your three players in the middle of the park. So you need help out there. So I think after 25 minutes, I'm not just saying it, but after 25 minutes, I said, this is horrific. We're so stuck in the mud. We can't get any passing going. They'd obviously identified Kieran Clarke as the weak spot. They let the ball go to Clarkey. And then they said to Clarkey, you know, the only pass we're giving you is to Ender Stevens. And that's basically like a foghorn going off that the hunt is on. As soon as the ball goes to Ender Stevens, you watch them go. They're off and they're hunting. And then they show Ender back inside to where they've left their three inside. And because you only have one wing back, their fullback now gets to stay at home in the back four. So you've now created a mismatch 4-v-2. James Collins and Robertson against the back four. So you're set there, no problem. Even if Ireland go long, we've got a 4v2, so Luxembourg are happy to deal with it. But ultimately, what you want to do is you want to get into Stevens' back inside where you're 3v3, and you turn the ball over, and they came prepared for that. And I think the best thing to do then is to change the system and then throw it back on them. So if you change, go to a flat back four, you need to get like three number 10s on the pitch. You get wide players, but tuck them in behind their midfield, and then the fullbacks have a decision to make. Do I go and engage with the wide man? And all of a sudden, you've created a little bit of a problem for them. But they got into a nice rhythm where we just kept doing exactly what they wanted to. And the longer the game went on, you could see they were growing. They were getting more confident. The wind was kind of with them. And I just felt he needed to change it because the die of the game had been set and it was just happening. And it was just kept happening. Probably half time, I think Stephen probably must have thought, geez, this ain't great. And I mean, even then you might come up second half and go, we'll give this 10 minutes. And if this doesn't change, we need to... I mean, I'd have done it after 25 minutes, to be honest with you. Because, you know, when you play against real... If we're playing against Italy and they do something like that to you and then you change your shape, the top-level players don't need the manager to tell them. They're real top-level players mentally as well as technically and whatever, tactically. They figure out straight away themselves, the real good ones. And they'll change it themselves. They'll know, okay, fair enough, you're going man for man. Okay, we're going to change this, the real good ones. But I think if you'd have flipped it back onto Luxembourg, that was built on a house of cards. You know, they would have had nothing else. Then you would have got them, you know. And that's just where I felt the game went. So that's just my thoughts on it, really.
Stephen described, actually, the formation beforehand. Tony O'Donoghue asked him, I don't know if this bit of the interview got aired. I assume it did. He described his formation as kind of 3-4-1-2.
Yeah, he said that again today. Yeah, that's how he likes to describe it.
Yeah, now, I think Kenny...
3-5-2.
Yeah, I know. Exactly. You can Kenny, I think, did a piece before kickoff. It was reflecting on the Serbia game where he said, I think we just weren't as positive or proactive in the middle or forward third, where you think, okay, there's a pass on, see it, and just be bold and be a little bit brave. It was all a little bit laboured. It was a little bit slow. The people were a bit cautious in making passes. And I felt the same as the pattern in the first half. And I remember halftime thinking, like, I think we'd only one shot on target. I think the keeper only made one save in the first half. And you're thinking 45 minutes at home, you either change it up, you start to do it better. And the do it better that I had in mind was... There was, you know, you just really see really crisp passing and you see lads demanding the ball and you can hear them roar and they're always looking, they're comfortable on it. And I think, Owen, you tweeted this afterwards in reaction to Seamus Coleman's interview, which now I understand sometimes you can just use phrases in post-match and you have to be critical of yourself and your teammates and you have to just own up to a load of failings in an interview like that. There's no wriggle room for you to look for positives anywhere if you're Seamus Coleman in that post-match interview situation. But he mentioned the fact that the players didn't want the ball. And remember who's in charge and remember what he's saying he's going to bring to the table. And he's going to bring to the party a comfort on the ball and a willingness to pass and just do it differently because we can and we're better. And so those are the messages he's been saying publicly, but he assumed delivering privately. And it just wasn't on show. There was none of that on Saturday.
I don't think it was there, though, Rich. I do take your point, but I think that the way they set up, they took away all the things that we were expecting when they matched us up in midfield and they let it go to the wing back and they funneled us down these little corners and they backed us up. And then our confidence drained very, very quickly.
It was gone. There was no confidence. There was no on the ball confidence. Like when whoever, like you could pretty much name anyone in the middle of the park, but they were getting it and giving it back to where they came from, or it was a little bit slow. It was a little bit.
I do think they took it away. They knew what we were coming to do. They knew what we wanted, and they took it away. And when they took it away, we panicked a little bit. The players, they're not top level players. Where if you take away one, they real elite level centre back can. You know, if you take away the number 6, they can fire into a number 10. If you take away the 10, they can drop it into the 9's chest, anything like that. But, like, obviously, Kieran Clark was expecting something. The first time he got the ball, you could see. Do you remember he played one into Knight and there was 3 players around him? He got caught in it. And I think Clarky was told, get it into Knight. That's your pass. Get it into your 6. Get it into your 6. So when Clarky got it, he looked and he went, well, there's my 6. There's 3 around him. Oh, I'll give it to him. And he gave it to him and it was terrible. So they took away what we wanted and then we didn't have anything to follow up with. And that's why I felt we needed to change it.
Yeah, a tiny bit of in defense, a little bit of Kenny on the formation thing, Damien. there's been no continuity. We've outlined that again in today's podcast. There's been no continuity of selection. It's been very difficult. So the one time he gets a clear week, there's no COVID, there's no, only, you know, with the usual injuries, but nothing, you know, nothing further during the week. I can see why he might have thought, do you know what? I'm just going to go with what worked to an extent the other night. But that doesn't necessarily excuse him not adapting during the game.
Absolutely not. But you know what, right? And Seamus said it, I'd say, a couple of days before the Serbia game when someone asked him about it or something. And he said something about, like, we had a lot of meetings about 3-5-2, or it might have been just after the Serbia game or something like that, maybe, you know. And I remember thinking to myself, ooh, you're in trouble. Because if you can't get on the pitch and work on 3-5-2, meetings are great, because but all you do in meetings is you create situations in your tactics board, and then you go, okay, if this happens, you do this and this, and that's all fine. But, you know, like Mike Tyson saying, you know, everyone's got a plan until they get punched in the face. And like when you're on the pitch and someone doesn't do what you're expecting, it creates a huge amount of indecision, that things that you can't. And the only way you earn that out is on the training pitch, 11v11s, practice matches. The reason the Italians love that, and anyone that's played for an Italian manager, they're the most boring managers. You do shape for 90 minutes a day. Italian managers are played in Italy. You don't get five aside. You barely get a passing drill. Every day shape. And that's why, because they want to like create a situation where if there are any flaws in it, there are any kinks, there is any indecision, it's going to show up on a Tuesday morning, and then you can talk about it. They'll video the training session, and if something happens, a goal goes in, go back over it and say, oh, well, here's the problem. You made the wrong decision here. If this happens on Saturday, you revert to this, or I would like you to do this, and that's where it all gets ironed out. You can't iron that out in a meeting, because the only thing you can do in a meeting is create hypothetical situations, and usually they're hypothetical situations that you have an answer for, you know, and that's not very fair. But I think you're dead right there, Owen. There was an awful lot of uncertainty around the Ireland team going into this, you know, the week before the Serbia game. With injuries, COVID, you know, there's still a couple of questions and marks hanging over, whatever. You then don't throw a formation change into the pot. I think that's the time where you just revert back to safety and just go, okay, let's maybe not put the seatbelt on a little bit, but let's just, you know, slow down. You know, we've enough on our plate here. We've got a young team, a real young team, and we don't want to throw... how many of them guys have played 3-5-2, the likes of, you know, James Collins or, you know, Robinson? I know I keep going back to the formation and whatever. I know I'll harp on about it a bit more, and there's an awful lot more going on than that. But just on the games that I've seen, I don't think it was great. But I just think that when there's a lot of question marks, you just put your seatbelt on a little bit and just go, okay, listen, we can still be as attacking as we want, and we still play our football, but let's do it from a good foundation. Let's not throw that into the pot as well.
I wonder what impact as well internally, and I'm not sitting here questioning the character or the professionalism or the decency of the players in the Ireland squad, but I just wonder what impact the results, the mood, the headlines this morning and yesterday, and all the conversations around the manager and whether he's the right person. I just wonder internally within the squad how all of that is being managed. Like, they're
More important, right? Because on the one hand, you got lots of kind of reaction to it, saying, oh, this is embarrassing, this is the lowest point, losing to Luxembourg and all this kind of stuff. But I wonder about what actually matters inside the squad. There's a couple of things that occurred to me. One is what you've just been talking about there, Damien, in terms of not addressing this problem, which was kind of obvious to everybody, this Clark Stevens zone of the pitch that the entire game was happening in, much to our this was not the game plan. It was not good for us that was happening, and yet nothing was really done to change it, I guess. And we sort of, okay, so maybe there's an issue there where players are going, this guy didn't react. You know, he do players that quickly begin to think, I'm not sure about this guy? The other thing that occurred to me, and that we'd mentioned a bit earlier, was what did you think about the late double substitution and leaving Hendrick on the bench? What do you think Hendrick's reaction is to that?
Well, just to go back to what Richie said there about the bits of the squad, I wouldn't have any real problems there, because I have total faith in Seamus Coleman. I think he is a top fella, like really and truly a player, but also as a captain as well. And all the things I hear about him is he has really taken to this captaincy role, taking the responsibility to lead this group. And if there is a time where the players might have to have a meeting or a sit down and say, hey, listen, you know, it's happening. We're getting a lot of criticism. You know, I would trust Seamus to stand up in a team meeting and just speak and just say, hey, listen, you know, we need to stick together. You know, obviously we take the criticism on board. So just to answer what Richie asked there, I don't think we could be in better hands, to be honest with you.
I don't think that's not always enough. A rallying call from a captain of immense integrity, and everyone respects him, and like, no, there's nobody questions him at all in any area of his play or his personality. But you know what it's like. You've been in dressing rooms where there's just a sense that, and everyone starts seeing, like, after a team meeting, a manager says something, oh, geez, he said the opposite yesterday, or there's a little dispute between the manager and the number two, or a player maybe fronts up to a manager and you think, oh, God, his authority has been challenged here, and it just starts to seep in. And then there's the wider landscape where Stephen is just getting pillared from everywhere now. And you just think, does that then start to add into the, maybe the lads who aren't playing think, okay, you know, I'm not mad about the manager because he's not picking me, and no one's particularly mad about playing for Ireland because they're losing all the time. And whether or not that just creates a little crack between the staff and the players. And I only think it's a small one to all of a sudden become a big one, and then a big one makes a material impact on the impact of everything the manager and the staff says.
But I would trust Seamus, because I think a lot of people will gravitate to him, and I think he will set the tone. And he won't panic, and I think he'll say all the right things, and he'll look after the young fellas. I was in quite a few squads with Seamus, and you could see that in him already, even though there were some senior players. He's a good fella, and from what I hear, he really has developed amazingly well. And I think a lot of the lads will gravitate to him, and if you have the correct characters in senior positions, they set the tone of the squad. And if your main men in the changing room, your big characters, are iffy and they complain all the time and they're hammering the manager behind his back, or they're blaming so-and-so, or, you know, then you got problems in the changing room. But I think that the lads will gravitate to him, and he will set the right example. He will set the right tone. I wouldn't have any fear.
So do you think then it's been, in hindsight, a pretty massive mistake by Stephen Kenny to leave Seamus Coleman out for most of the first? I mean, he's obviously back in now, but he did leave him out for like the first few.
That's a playing point of view. And I can guarantee you, I know for a fact that Seamus would still have been the same character, the same leader, the same everything. And those stories about him complaining about getting dragged to press conferences, that is all absolute rubbish. You know, the guy is the captain of Ireland. He loves being captain of Ireland. And he is the right type of character, whether he's playing or whether he's not playing. He's the man. Anyway, what was your question there, Ken? I forgot. Sorry.
But I hope, I wonder from now on, sorry, if we're going to see similar, but like obviously new versions of the, you know, the story about the video at Wembley, or the story about Coleman and the press conference, where it's, The purpose of the story, whatever about the content of it, is it chips away at the manager's authority, or just it's an anti-Stephen Kenny story. And I just wonder if the next little while we'll start to see more and more leaks like that, because if we do, that obviously is completely unhelpful.
Richie, what about the broader question that's been raised over the last couple of days? Brian Kerr was one of the first I saw who sit beside Damien, who made the point on Saturday night that tonight isn't just down to Stephen's faults or the team's faults.
No.
It's a fault of a lack of proper player development structure and coaching structure, a dearth of talent coming through. Suddenly, Stephen is pouring players through to the senior team that were successful but aren't ready, were successful at underage. There's no real quality or depth. That's been proven. And the people who are in charge of that development should seriously be looking at themselves tonight rather than just criticising the manager. And that's not, he's not just talking about the way Irish football has been run over the last 20 years and the fact that we had a former CEO whose tenure didn't exactly work out. He's talking about other people there as well and saying that the job just hasn't been done correctly. How true do you think that is? And how much of an excuse or a reason is that to explain away no wins in 10 games for the current manager?
Look, I'm sure if I bother to look, I'm sure I've done one or two or three columns with the Sunday Independent a decade ago, similar to that, where you... it's the same thing again. It's always this question mark over us as a country, or the FAI specifically as an organisation. Do we have any idea how to develop players to elite level? Because England or the UK have done it previously. Anyone above the age of 15 was just sent over there. And we've a completely underdeveloped senior structure. And the youths now are all in the hands of the League of Ireland, the one group of clubs who've shown with phenomenal consistency over the years that they're fucking basket cases, and they're really financially poor as well, bar a couple of them who are doing really good work at academy level. The money ring fence for player development within the FAI has shrunk from 400 grand to 80 grand. So I don't know if we're going to see a huge improvement in that area anytime soon. But these are all the wider Irish football landscape like points that, again, you could make at any point under the previous manager or the manager before that. So that's the nature of Irish football at the moment, and it's an unavoidable fact that comes with being the manager. But I don't think, and I don't think Brian Kerr was trying to do this, but I don't think that is enough for us to avoid asking the question as to whether or not, like, you know, Stephen is the fella to have the job beyond this campaign.
Sounds like you're losing your faith, but I don't think any of the four of us are talking about Stephen Kenny getting the heave ho.
No, I don't think that. But
at the end of the current contract, which runs out at the end of the campaign, that's, you know, I guess that's the question. As you said the other night, Richie, he still has a lot of work to do to prove that he's the right man to go forward from that point, to be the manager after this qualification.
Yeah, there's going to be two or three friendlies, a half dozen qualifying games. So 8-9 games between now and the end of the year. And we will know more then. And we will know. We'll get obviously an idea as to whether the weekend was the low point from which we built, or whether it was shockingly a plateau and we just didn't actually shift from this. And we're having the exact same conversation after every match, where we're talking about the what ifs, or we're making the mitigating circumstances because for whatever reason. And then you fall into the category going, are we talking about positive results, or are we talking about excuses? Because from day one we've been talking about excuses because we haven't had positive results yet. So that can't continue indefinitely, but that's a question for the end of the year.
Damien, is there any positives to take from having another game, this bizarre friendly against
belter of a fixture?
Yeah, absolute belter. I mean, is there a way you can play Saturday night out of your system?
Yeah, definitely. I think you ask any of the players, they want to play again. I mean, the ones that don't are no good to you anyway, because that means it's in their makeup that when the going gets tough, they throw a towel in. I think a lot of the players who haven't played these last two games will be chomping at the bit to get in and say, hey, listen, you know, you decided to go in a new direction and maybe I wasn't part of that, but I'm still here. And if they can put in a serious performance and beat Qatar, then they'll go back to their clubs an awful lot happier that when they come back in the summer, they'll be more in contention, really. So I do expect to see some changes. Hope that there's some changes. I know there's some faces that we've seen an awful lot of over the last number of years that will certainly come back in. But then there's also lads who are kind of on the periphery that might stick their hand up as well. So it's a good fixture. You know, anytime you get to play a game, you get to learn a little bit more. Perhaps a good result and a good performance can be, if we're saying we've hit rock bottom and we've plateaued there, maybe we can just inch our way forward with something positive. You know, we're all talking about going in the right direction. I think we're going there yet, but I think we're pointing in the right direction. And I think that maybe a performance, or at worst a performance, but a really good result, I suppose, would kind of nudge us in the direction.
I mean, that was supposed to be the nice, soft closing question. But then that phrase you used, that we're pointing in the right direction. I don't. Where's the evidence for that? I just don't see it. I'd love to see it. By the way, I want this to be a success, and I'm in the camp of Stephen Kenny fans. But I don't see the evidence that we're pointing in the right direction after what we saw.
He deserves a go at this. You know, he deserves time to implement this, especially now if it's all but, or hopes of qualification are gone now, you know. So making a change now is irrelevant. Might as well just, you know, we're pot committed with Stephen now, so might as well just keep going, give him the full campaign. And if we do see some, what is it, six games left plus the friendlies and whatever else, not in the next couple of, next year, if we do see that we're pointing in the right direction and we have nudged the needle a little bit, then I think he deserves maybe another crack at another campaign. But he does need to give us something to sell, because I want to sell Stephen Kenny. I was his biggest fan, you know that, Owen, and I pushed him as hard as anyone, and I want to help him, but he's got to give me something that I can sell. And unfortunately at the minute it's a bit difficult, but I'm still positive.
Still positive. The High Priest, Richie Sadler, seems to be wavering somewhat. Lads, we'll leave it at that. Brilliant stuff. Sorry to drag you over all that stuff again, but we really appreciate a good chat. Thanks a mil.
Thanks, boys.
Cheers, lads.
First of all, I'd like to welcome John Delaney here today.
Trying to be critical is well being possible. Building a house, you build the foundations first. The chimney is the top. The chimney for us is international football.
As well as to John Delaney, the pleasure, the entertainment, the organisation, the skills that you take to everybody is fantastic.
But you don't have a chimney unless you've got a very strong foundations.
Email in here from David Kelly, who wants a conversation about what the role of an international manager actually is. He says they have a few training sessions with the team to prepare them for the match. Essentially, he says the discussions around international manager overlooked what it really is, the 11 best players in the country being thrown on the pitch without any time for the manager to influence the style of play, and then they hope to get a bit of luck along the way. France won the World Cup with the best players despite a basic type of football. National teams with any recognisable identities are heavily reliant on club teams from that nation playing a certain way and then picking those players, like Barcelona with Spain, Ajax with Holland back in the day. A good example of the modern international manager is Gareth Southgate. Didn't do a great job at club level, took the senior job after having the under-21s, and he took over the seniors from a manager who played football from a bygone era at short notice. Sound familiar? My impression is Southgate's role is as a motivator and facilitator of a very talented group of players. This works within the FA as it is a well-run organisation producing world-class players. Stephen Kenny is a decent manager doing an okay job with a group of kids and average players who aren't starting for their clubs. My theory is no matter who was in charge, the results wouldn't change. Whether we're hoofing it long or passing it short, the reason we're not going to a World Cup isn't because of the manager, it's because we don't deserve to. John Delaney said, if you're building a house, you build the foundations first. Well, the house is subsiding, and it's not because a new tenant moved in and repainted the kitchen. As a nation, we need to accept Italia 90 won't happen again. We're a small country with a bad football team. We have to come to terms with that. We need to relax, get a few kegs of Guinness into the players at the hotel. We can all just embrace mediocrity. Give Kenny a few years with the players he brings in the under-21s, see what happens. They might surprise us, and if not, just sack him and let the next sucker take the reins. Anyway, I'm aware this nihilistic outlook on sport isn't great sports podcast content, but I feel it isn't a view that gets talked about too much. Congratulations on the 2000 episodes. Gene, by the way, says, Gene has spoken, he says, the show regularly calls for Jose to be moved on, surely then ...
I prefer really not to speak.
Just thought I'd give Gene his moment before we wrap things up. Murphy, you've been looking a little bit closer at the world rankings there.
Well, you know, I mean, why not? I mean, let's just have a look. Since, as Ken says, 98 was mentioned a lot over the course of the last 4 or 5 days. Name a team that are pretty much exactly halfway between Ireland and Luxembourg in the world rankings. So we're 42nd, Luxembourg are 98th. This team are 68th. Bulgaria. Bulgaria. Israel are...
But they're awful.
Yeah.
I mean, they beat us, I think.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Israel are 87th. Scotland drew with them on Sunday. We drew with them whenever that
Scotland
was.
Scotland have played a lot of games. I saw... Or was it Rich Shawley had the stat that Andy Robertson has played in as many Scotland Israel games as Man United Liverpool games since 2018. Six in total.
Georgia are 89th. Georgia, who were beaten by a last minute goal by Spain, that their keeper really should have saved.
I wouldn't fancy ourselves against Georgia right now.
It's just like it is pretty like these world rankings. Like you know, the Ivory Coast are 62nd or something. You know. I'm not entirely sure that the world ranking is, you know, a 100% reliable arbiter of how good or bad an international team is. I mean, our emailer is... It's an interesting point our emailer makes, is that maybe the person most important in these situations is, a visionary chief executive of a football association who realises
I completely agree.
Yeah, like...
I completely agree with that email. That email's on the money.
Yeah, did we perhaps have a suboptimal leadership situation in the FAI over the last 15 or 20 years? See, the thing is about this entire conversation that we've been having over the last 3 or 4 days as a nation is that if you decide to actually think about it yourself, as opposed to being this reinforces what I already thought, you know, a year ago, if you actually think, you end up agreeing with a lot of what people say, you know, and this idea that it has to be, you know, dinosaurs on one side and, you know, football visionaries on the other side. I mean, it's just, that's just not how it is. I mean, you can think multiple things about this Ireland team situation at the same time. And it, you can be really depressed about it, really annoyed about it, really annoyed at some decisions that Stephen Kenny made. And also just be cognizant of the fact that you, this idea that you can have leadership as bad, as terrible, as like world record breakingly awful as we've had in the FAI over the last 20 years, and it not matter really on the pitch. I mean, that, yeah, you know, like, come on, like, it can't be that.
It's insane.
If it was as simple as hiring Big Sam and you could do whatever you liked as the FAI chief executive, then, then there's no sense to anything. There's literally no sense to how the world is organized in any realm, let alone football.
Yeah, I mean, like, we have to remember that we live in a country in which the best-selling book of 2020 was about the football administrators. Like, that,
that's how bad, know, they were.
that's how bad they were. That, so you know, and it turns out that our team is a bit of a mess. Well, you know, I mean, let's just, again, like, maybe the email sounds a little bit sort of black-pilled or whatever. I'm with that. I think that's the fact. You know, why are we so angry about Luxembourg? Because we want to be tuppence halfpenny looking down on tuppence, right? we're angry tuppence halfpenny that we can't look down on tuppence anymore. And you know, that's just, we just need to get over it, as the man said, get over it, get on with it, and accept that. Look, things are going to be better than this at some point in the future. But even if they're not, you know, that's still okay.
Okay. Will they be better? Okay. Will they be better on Tuesday night against Qatar? Find out.
By the way, if Qatar were in our World Cup group as opposed to just being like, you know, invited along for the ride, they'd be top of the group, by the way, after two games. Sure, they've only played Azerbaijan and Luxembourg, but the fact remains that as it stands, Qatar stand atop group, whatever the fucking name of the group that we're in. They would be top of the group.
We'll have a football podcast for you on Wednesday. We're also going to continue the 2000 podcast series. Big interview with Greg Louganis tomorrow. Thanks, Murph. Thanks, Ken. Enjoyed that. Well, did I enjoy that? Well, it was a conversation that needed to be had.
Thank you, Owen. Thank you, Ken.
Yeah, you squirted out plenty of venom all over that conversation. I hope you probably need a bit more time for your little poison sack to refill.
Much obliged.
Let's leave Owen's poison sack out of this.
That's the second time it's gone off. They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's the persuaders of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.